Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Carla Pariser. Today I'll be reading from the summer 2024 issue of Connecticut Explored. The first article is the Hog River Journal, Monuments and Monumental Arguments by Kathy Herms. We welcome Dr. Matthew Washer of Central Connecticut State University as our guest editor for our summer 2024 issue. He solicited and curated the articles here. As a scholar and public historian of antebellum and Civil War era Connecticut, Dr. Washer approached us about an issue theme of monuments and memory. There was a large interest in this topic at a meeting of our organizational and community partners as our nation debates questions over what monuments to keep, contextualize, and create. This issue concerns monuments, historical memory, and even to some degree reminiscence. Whether created by governments or private entities, monuments are products of their time that can shape the public perception of the past. Historical memory is collective memory, the way in which a group tells the story of its past. Reminiscence or personal memory may or may not comport with any other narrative. At Connecticut Explored, we promise you one good story after another, but our editorial board, authors, and staff try to ensure those stories are rooted in evidence. You will find something in this issue we have not done before, a point-counterpoint approach to a historical controversy. The controversy surrounds the monuments to John Mason, an early settler in the Connecticut colony, who, among other things, played an outsized role in the Pequot War and later served as the colony's deputy governor and then acting governor. Mason's reputation as a war hero and dedicated servant of the Connecticut colony contrasts with his role in the slaughter of noncombatant Pequots at Mystic, and perhaps to a lesser extent, his role in the Hartford witchcraft panic in the 1660s, while Governor John Winthrop Jr. was in England procuring the Connecticut Charter from King Charles II. In this issue, we also feature others with legacies in Connecticut, like Reverend Thomas Gallaudet and P.T. Barnum. Someone's historical legacy is what they are remembered for, as opposed to the sum total of their lives. A legacy is actually about the present, the way in which a person matters in our contemporary world. Legacies help connect the past to the present, even though they change over time. Reflection is rarely a bad thing, and as we reflect on a few of our state's many monuments, legacies, and historical narratives will come face to face with great accomplishments, dismal failures, and everything in between. Our partner, Connecticut Humanities, is celebrating 50 years of funding numerous historical projects and fostering conversations about our past. We are also preparing to commemorate America's 250th anniversary as a nation, a republic founded in a tradition of argument. In an August 1651 letter to Major John Endicott, Roger Williams, founder of Providence Plantation in the colony of Rhode Island, rejoiced that he lived in wonderful, searching, disputing, and dissenting times. We certainly live in disputing times now, and sometimes that dissension feels like it will tear us apart. But like Williams, I think wonderful things can come out of disputes and dissent, as long as we are searching for what is right and true. The next article is written by Stories in Stone by Matthew Washer, the guest editor. In the fall of 2022, I had the wonderful opportunity to teach a course at Central Connecticut State University, CCSU, titled Stories in Stone, The American Monument Controversy. My fascination with monuments and memorials was sparked by the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, and especially by reading David Ransom's study of Connecticut's more than 150 Civil War monuments, published by the Connecticut Historical Society, now the Connecticut Museum of Culture and History, in 1997. What had long been hidden in the blur of my peripheral vision suddenly stood out, defined in all their stone majesty. It's not that I was unaware of monuments and their importance. I'm a historian, after all. Rather, I didn't necessarily feel any emotional connection to them. That changed as I studied our state's involvement in the Great Rebellion and came to realize that thermo monuments and memorials dotting virtually every city and town's landscape were the outpouring of grief, deep, mournful grief at the loss of sons, brothers, and fathers. The early monument spoke to loss and trauma, to death. As monumentation grew in popularity, the memorials took on new meanings: resilience, civic pride, service to one's community and nation, and symbolism about the meaning of the war. For 16 weeks, students at CCSU studied monuments broadly, not just to the Civil War, but also shrines and memorials to Columbus, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, and Theodore Roosevelt, among others. Closer to home, we explored and debated John Mason, one of the founders of the Connecticut colony, and a military commander who, in 1637, set fire to the Mystic Pequot Fort, killing some 400 to 600 Pequot men, women, and children. Monuments to Mason on Windsor's Palisado Green and the Connecticut Capitol Building are among the most controversial in our state. How do we shape and develop stories over time? And is it natural for those stories and the monuments that represent them to change? We can also reflect on what a monument or memorial is. The definition goes beyond formal statuary and includes buildings like the Barnum Museum in Bridgeport and the historic Buckley Bridge in Hartford. Special thanks to Kathy Hermes and Kristen Leventhan for their unceasing support and enthusiasm as we developed the issue and worked with authors to fine-tune these excellent essays. Special thanks to Kathy Hermes and Kristen Leventhan for their unceasing support and enthusiasm as we developed the issue and worked with authors to fine-tune these excellent essays. The next article was written by Kristen Leventhan and is entitled A Monumental Endeavor, The Buckley Bridge. The October 9, 1908 edition of the Hartford Courant was rapturous in its description of Bridge Week, a three-day celebration that accompanied the dedication of the Hartford Bridge. William Gunn, Hartford's police chief, reported that 250,000 revelers clogged the city streets, taking in parades, pageantry, and spectacles, such as a reenactment of Thomas Hooker and his followers crossing the Connecticut River and arriving in Hartford. As a boy, Francis Goodwin II, a founder of the Hartford Symphony Orchestra, played one of Hooker's acolytes, wearing buckled knee breeches, a little black jacket with wide white collar, and a broad-rimmed, high-pointed hat. In the three great days, Goodwin's presentation of his recollections of Bridge Week to the Monday Evening Club of Hartford in October 1967, he declared that Hartford had never seen such a great and glorious party. For most of history, those who wanted to cross the Connecticut River at the place that became Hartford were left to their own devices. In Crossing the Connecticut, George E. Wright outlined the later options. In December 1681, Hartford gave Thomas Cadwell the right to run a public ferry. This ferry and its successors served the public for over a century until a toll bridge was constructed in 1810. That wooden structure was destroyed by ice and flooding in 1818 and was soon replaced by the old Hartford Toll Bridge, which connected Morgan Street in Hartford and Connecticut Avenue in East Hartford. When that crossing succumbed to fire on May 17, 1895, the General Assembly created the Connecticut River Bridge and Highway District Commission to design and finance a new modern bridge to accommodate Connecticut's rapid industrialization and population growth. Construction of the Hartford, now Buckley Bridge, took 3 years and cost $3 million, the equivalent of over $100 million in 2024. The nine arches of the neoclassical stone bridge featured concrete foundations and granite from Guilford's Leets Island and Branford's Stony Creek. In a review for Cassiers Magazine and Engineering Monthly, April 1908, E. W. Winans praised the bridge, declaring that its size of arch, of length and breadth, combined with its perfection of structure and symmetry of outline, make plain the claim of superiority. This superiority was largely to the credit of the sand hogs, who tolled tirelessly in perilous conditions beneath the riverbed, carving out the foundation for each granite arch. In the sand hogs, set the foundation for the Bulkley Bridge, ConnecticutHistory.org, August 15, 2020, Steve Thornton found that many of these sandhogs were black laborers who earned no more than $2.50 a day. According to the March 1993 National Registry of Historic Places application submitted by the Connecticut Department of Transportation, CTDOT, building the Hartford Bridge was the largest civic improvement project undertaken in the Hartford area up to the time, one which included a City Beautiful inspired vision that extended beyond the bridge's footprint. Connecticut Boulevard was created on the east side to give visitors a grand approach to the capital city. To make room for a riverside approach to the bridge between Morgan and Pleasant Streets, on the west side, tenement housing and small business buildings were raised, displacing hundreds of families. These improvements disappeared a few decades later when the construction of Interstates 84 and 91 even more dramatically altered the neighborhoods of Hartford. The Hartford Bridge was renamed the Bulkley Bridge in 1922 in memory of Morgan Bulkley, who chaired the Connecticut River Bridge and Highway District Commission that issued the bonds that financed the bridge. Among other distinctions, Bulkley was a Civil War veteran, the first president of baseball's National League, president of the Aetna Life Insurance Company, mayor of Hartford, governor of Connecticut, and a United States senator. Like any public figure, Bulkley had his detractors, but naming the bridge after him has caused little controversy. In fact, the CTDOT recently held a meeting to share its plan to add aesthetic lighting to the landmark bridges, the Hartford Current, February 2, 2024. As the CTDOT shines new light on Morgan Bulkley and his bridge, these photos illuminate a fuller story of the bridge's construction and legacy. And there are a few photos that display exactly what this article articulates. The next article was written by Kristen Steves and is entitled Courage and Camaraderie Under the Arch. On the second Saturday of October, thousands of runners converge on Hartford. The excitement is palpable. Music fills Bushnell Park, tents and spectators line the streets, and hundreds of colorful mums form a pathway on Trinity Street. The festive atmosphere reaches a crescendo during the Hartford Marathon, a monumental event ingrained in the city's spirit. According to the race's founder, Beth Schluger, she strategically designed the 26.2-mile course to finish under Connecticut's largest monument, the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Arch. Indeed, the arch in the center of Bushnell Park is the official symbol of the Hartford Marathon Foundation. In an article celebrating the race's 25th anniversary, the Hartford Current reported that since its inception in 1994, over 200,000 runners have participated, receiving medals and T-shirts adorned with the monument. Thus, the arch appears everywhere, all the time. It's not uncommon to see a runner, alone or in a bunch, making their way down a street while wearing the iconic arch logo. It has been embraced as a contemporary community symbol of the human need to join others, participate in a cause, and remember. Yet, of the many people who run and volunteer at the marathon, as well as the wide variety of other organizations that for more than a century have gathered at the arch's imposing grand brownstone towers, how many are aware of its historical significance, its deep meaning to the Civil War generation that also wanted to gather, to remember? This realization is deeply personal for me. I first stood beneath the arch during the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure, an event devoted to raising money for and awareness of breast cancer. In 2010, my mom was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer, which devastated my family. In our need to commune with others struggling with this horrible disease, we found ourselves walking for the cure for the first time in 2011. Thousands dressed in pink made their annual pilgrimage under the arch. I was in awe of the people from so many different backgrounds whose lives were impacted by this disease. Walking beneath the arch, I was engulfed in the stories of survivors, caregivers, and those who had lost loved ones. We marched for a cause as a community bound by resilience and hope. Amid a pink sea, I found solace and a sense of belonging at an isolating and scary time. A year or so later, while earning my history teaching degree at Central Connecticut State University, I came to understand the arch's meaning. Like those of us gathering in 2011, the Civil War generation in Connecticut sought community and a place to assemble and remember. They dedicated the country's first triumphal arch on September 17, 1886, the 24th anniversary of the Battle of Antietam, the bloodiest day in American history. The following day, the Hartford Courant ran a front-page article reporting on the festivities. Clouds loomed in the sky, and the sun refused to shine. Yet that didn't stop nearly 20,000 people from coming together to honor the soldiers and sailors of Hartford who served the Union during the Civil War. The streets were filled, the mood festive and cheerful. The sheer number of people underscored the effects of the war on Connecticut's residents. In the fall of 1881, the city of Hartford budgeted $60,000 to construct a Civil War monument and appointed a committee to adopt a plan. Like many Civil War monuments, the arch was intended to serve as a reminder of sacrifice and survival. An inscription on the tower of the arch proclaims, "In honor of the men of Hartford who served, and in memory of those who fell, their grateful townsmen raised this memorial." Placed over the existing Ford Street Bridge in Park River, the monument would serve as the entrance to Bushnell Park, the nation's first common built for and funded solely by local citizens. An open contest invited local artists to submit designs. The Hartford Courant reported on January 22, 1884, that many proposals were too costly or failed to meet expectations. After much consideration, the committee asked George Keller, Hartford's leading architect, to submit a design. Keller's design featured classical, medieval, and Gothic elements. He recognized the importance of keeping within budget, using local Portland brownstone and terracotta. In May 1884, the committee adopted the plan and construction began. Research carried out by David Ransom for the Connecticut Historical Society, now the Connecticut Museum for Culture and History, reveals the design elements of the monument. Two cylindrical towers, each 116 feet tall, stand as the architectural supports of the monument. They are topped with conical roofs, and on each stands an angel, Gabriel on the west tower holding two trumpets, and Raphael on the east tower holding cymbals. Together they face south, welcoming soldiers home from war. The four military services are identified on the towers: an anchor for the navy, cannons for the artillery, cross sabers for the cavalry, and rifles for the infantry. The east tower is also the final resting place for George Keller and his wife Mary. Their ashes have been in the arch since he died in 1935. A silent army of almost 100 soldiers is carved into the frieze that encircles the bridge of the arch, revealing a vivid and graphic story from the beginning to the end of the war that captures the spirit of sacrifice. Designed by Samuel Kitson, a British sculptor living in the United States, the north facade illustrates chaotic scenes of war. General Ulysses S. Grant sits on horseback, surveying the Union army as they advance upon the Confederates. On the opposite side of the frieze, naval troops dodge cannon fire as they jump from their ships to join the battle. Caspar Buber, an American sculptor, designed the South Frieze, which chronicles the return of peace. A noble female figure representing the city of Hartford sits directly at the center. To her right on a shield is the seal of Hartford, the heart, or stag, surrounded by Connecticut's ubiquitous grapevines. Like the angels, Hartford's lady faces south, welcoming home returning soldiers. Some are shown on horseback or ship or being greeted by their wives and children. Others are grievously wounded, leaning on one another as they journey north. After the Union victory, Connecticut bore the scars of sacrifice. More than 5,000 of the state's men died during the war, and it was almost impossible for families to escape the loss of a father, brother, husband, or son. The arch depicts six figures representing the ordinary men who traded their tools for weapons to defend the Union. The statues encourage us to reflect not only on the individuals they represent, but also on the countless untold stories of courage and camaraderie that unfolded on the battlefields and in the hearts of those who became soldiers for a cause greater than themselves. Standing at a larger-than-life 8 feet tall are a farmer, carpenter, mason, blacksmith, student, and formerly enslaved man. Keller originally intended the final figure to be a merchant, but he changed it at the last moment. In one hand, the freed man holds broken shackles, and in the other, a slate with the letters ABC written, suggesting education was the key to black upward mobility. Interestingly, the formerly enslaved man was never acknowledged or mentioned in reports and commentaries on the arch until many years later. As outlined in Matthew Warshauer's and Mary M. Donahue's Spring 2011 Connecticut Explored article, Civil War, Memorials to a Nation Preserved, the arch is one of only three Connecticut Civil War monuments that reference slavery. According to a June 9, 1988 article in the Hartford Courant, a 1987 research paper by Arion Bethia, then a high school freshman in Hartford, inspired the installation of a second plaque to recognize the city's 128 black soldiers who died and who were not previously honored for their bravery and valor in the Great Civil War. Decades later, organizations dedicated to resilience and unity continued to gather under the arch's towering dignity. In July 2020, following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the painted words "Black Lives Matter" appeared on Trinity Street, just in front of the arch. Black Lives Matter 860 and Queen Sisters organized the Transformative Project, commissioning 16 local artists to create a vibrant tapestry of colors. Each letter is an individual piece of art which tells its own story. During a Juneteenth celebration, artist Latoya Dallaire, who painted the E in Lives, told the Hartford Courant, "It just stands for rising together as a community and love." Many groups utilize the arch as the centerpiece of public statements and gatherings. Acting as the gateway to Bushnell Park, the arch bears witness to some of the city's most unique events hosted by such varied organizations as the Connecticut Council for Interreligious Understanding, the Rocks Steady Dance Company, and the New England Fiddle Contest. Area residents attend Hartford Jazz Fest or First Night, which draws hundreds of families to enjoy music and fireworks. On October 5, 2011, the Hartford Courant noted that 30 people had occupied Bushnell Park in a demonstration to raise awareness of many issues, including unemployment, insurance reform, and wars abroad. The Connecticut Pride Committee held their annual celebration in the same location only a month earlier. On March 22, 2023, the Courant reported that 2,500 rallied in the park as part of the second Connecticut March for Life. The creators of Bushnell Park and the Arch never could have imagined the diversity of events and organizations that use this city centerpiece. Together, they continue the legacy of community and civic engagement. The Arch is a living testimony to the strength that surfaces when a community unites for a common purpose. It is easy to understand why Hartford Marathon founder Beth Schluger chose the arch as a symbol of the race. She explained, "It is an inspiration to our runners, believing that a magnificent view of this historical icon would instill a sense of awe within themselves as they achieve their hard-earned goal of completing a marathon. Whatever their reasons to win, honor a loved one, or reach a personal goal, the marathon inspires competitors and helps them persevere through seemingly insurmountable challenges." Linda Ambard runs for her husband, Major Phil Ambard, who was deployed during the Afghanistan War. He made her promise to continue her goal of running 50 marathons across the 50 states. He insisted that if anything happened to him, she should focus on something positive and find a way to connect with others. On April 27, 2010, Major Ambard was in a routine meeting when an Afghan pilot entered and shot 9 people and then himself. Ambard died, leaving behind Linda and their 5 children. But Linda kept her promise. The Hartford Courant reported on October 11, 2014, that Linda crossed the finish line under the iconic arch, finishing her 86th marathon. Rebecca Boncato ran her 8th marathon in Hartford in memory of a friend's son who was diagnosed with pediatric cancer and passed away before his first birthday. Boncato said, "I wanted to keep telling his story, so I started running. And running turned into something much bigger than running. In 2020, her reasons changed when her daughter, Joey, was diagnosed with cancer and endured almost 3 years of chemotherapy. In 2023, Boncato again crossed the finish line under the arch, cheered on by thousands of spectators and awaited by her daughter. The monument, intended to be a reminder of community, peace, and hope, came alive during these moments, resonating with those who found comfort and courage beneath its arching embrace. The Hartford Marathon has grown steadily, and in 2014, Eversource became the race's corporate sponsor. The Eversource Energy Foundation notes that the race brings more than $13 million in economic support to the region and raises more than $8 million for charity annually. Beneficiaries include the Connecticut Children's Medical Center, the Hospital for Special Care, and the Megan Schulman Memorial Foundation, which supports organizations committed to community enrichment and academic excellence. In 2020, the Hartford Marathon faced unprecedented challenges as the in-person event was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Instead, participants embraced the spirit of unity by running at locations of their choice. There would be no fanfare or finish line under the arch, a symbol synonymous with the race's meaning of coming together. Despite these changes, the community's commitment shone through. A November 14, 2020 article in the Hartford Courant highlighted that fundraising totals surpassed those of a typical race year and exceeded them by an impressive 27%. This remarkable achievement was due to the individuals who sought to contribute to something more meaningful than a race. Just as the participants ran individually, but in solidarity, the singular arch stands as a symbol of unity, representing the strength and resilience of the community. At a time when coming together was so important, this emphasizes the connection between the fundraising success and the enduring spirit and meaning embodied by the monument serving as the race's finish line. I have come to understand the emotional pull of the arch. At my second Susan G. Komen Walk for the Cure, after I had spent time studying the monument's history, I gathered once again under its towering visage, explaining its connection to the Civil War to my family and friends. I looked around and realized that dozens of people had closed in to hear the story of another generation's sacrifice, its need for kinship and human connection, and the call to remember. At that moment, I realized the monument was more than just a towering structure. It is a living testament to our shared history and the values of unity and coming together in times of adversity. The Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Arch has become more than designer George Keller might have imagined. It is more than stone and mortar. It is a silent storyteller. The arch symbolizes the very meaning of community, sacrifice, and tribute by acting as a sentinel and guide into Bushnell Park. Its namesake, Horace Bushnell, imagined the park as a place of life and motion that will make us more conscious of being one people. As the arch stands unwavering through the ages, its lessons reverberate through time, connecting the past, the present, and an ever-evolving future. When thousands of runners cross the finish line under the arch this October, let's hope they have an even greater appreciation of its legacy. That's it for this installation of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the summer 2024 issue of Connecticut Explored. I'm Carla Pariser. So long until next time.